brought to you by CGTN Europe.
Hello, I'm Stephen Cole, and welcome to the Agenda podcast. This week, just over 100 days into a new post-Brexit trading world, we're asking just what has really changed? And what does the future hold for relations and commercial transactions between the United Kingdom and the European Union? I spoke to James Sibley, Head of International Affairs at the UK's Federation of Small Businesses, and Ben Butters, the CEO of Eurochambers, which represents more than 20 million European businesses, to find out whether their members were happy 100 days in.
The prevailing mood among our members when the deal was struck was probably more one of relief than happiness. We avoided the worst case scenario of falling back on WTO terms with tariffs, quotas, and a lot of the disruption that would come with at the borders with that process. And that left a constructive basis for future relations. But at the same time, we can't escape the fact that the UK became a third country outside the EU, outside the single market, and outside a customs union. So there were inevitably going to be problems, and we would no longer have frictionless trade. So happy, no, but a basis from which to move forward.
James Sibley, what about small businesses here in the UK? What's changed for them over the last 100 days?
Well, small firms have seen the largest change to the UK's trading relationship with Europe and with the rest of the world in half a century. So a lot has changed. I mean, we've now left the European Union, we've left the single market and the customs union. And that has broad implications. So that now means for small firms trading in goods, customs checks. It means new requirements on food safety. There are new arrangements on VAT. So really, with cross-border trade, everything has changed.
But you expected all of that, didn't you?
We did, yes. So we knew that the government was negotiating a free trade agreement-based trading relationship with the EU. There were some things that were still unknown until the very last minute, such as on rules of origin, which is another thing that small firms now have to contend with.
And what do you make of the official figures of trade? I'm looking at them now between the UK and EU. They do make for pretty grim reading, but are they an accurate picture, do you think?
So the feeling is that, yes, they are quite dire, and yes, they are quite accurate from what we hear from our membership. So the big concern for us at the moment is those small firms who are now faced with the new requirements on paperwork, new regulatory requirements and so on, and they're just put off from exporting. So we are hearing anecdotally quite a significant number of small firms who are looking at the new arrangements and saying, if this carries on for much longer, I'm not going to be able to continue doing business with the EU. And that's a big concern. So yes, the figures we feel do paint a picture of what's going on at the moment.
Are all these, do you think, Ben Butters, do you think all these are teething problems or are there fundamental issues that you think still need to be ironed out?
I don't really agree with the notion of teething problems. That would suggest that things are going to improve, but they won't, because we're facing major structural changes here. This isn't a temporary situation. Of course, there's an adaptation period from everyone, and we need to improve certain aspects of the implementation, and that's why we would hope to have some more clarity fairly soon about the different committees and subcommittees within the agreement that are going to discuss the implementation. But fundamentally, this is a very different set of rules, and it's going to be with us for years to come. I don't think that the economic settlement is going to be renegotiated at any time soon, so businesses need to adapt, and the authorities in charge of the different processes need to adapt as well.
And James, I take it you'd agree with that.
I do agree. Like Ben says, there is an adaption period as businesses, hauliers, logistics firms, even the border inspectors get used to the new rules. But the reality is that there are now significant structural changes in the UK-EU trading relationship. And that is due to leaving the single market and customs union. And that's a permanent feature that small firms in particular are going to have to adapt to.
And Ben Butters, are there particular sectors among your members who seem to be, disproportionately affected, do you think? I mean, what help do they need?
Well, there are certainly some sectors that are more exposed to these changes than others. We're hearing from the food sector, the automotive sector, health and drugs and pharmaceuticals. These are sectors that are traditionally very heavily interlinked between the UK and the EU. But the broader message we get that small and medium-sized enterprises are being affected disproportionately, and they need help. They need information. They need guidance. There are small businesses out there which have never completed a customs form before in their entire existence, and now within the space of a few weeks, that's become central to some of their activities. So they need help with that. They need advice on complying with rules of origin and guidance about movement of people. That's the real thing for us, to help the smaller businesses who, of course, are hit harder because they don't have a whole team behind them who can absorb the new requirements.
So apart from information, James, what else needs to be done now to make this transition go more smoothly, perhaps?
So, I mean, it really is just information that we can provide. I think lots of small firms will be encountering customs for the first time. They'll be encountering rules of origin for the first time. I've spoken to many companies who are doing brilliant things to adapt to this new situation. But there are many others who, like I say, they're learning really as they go. And we need to make sure that we can make it as easy as possible for them to understand this new environment that they're trading within.
But that was, James, in some ways always going to happen, wasn't it? Because after such a long relationship, any divorce is difficult.
Yes, it is very difficult. And unfortunately, some of this is really only going to be worked through with time. There's going to need to be time to adapt to the new relationship. And like I say, some of the changes haven't fully come in yet, such as the UK import check. So there's a while to go with this yet.
But James, the EU has launched legal action against the UK over the Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland. How much of that is a concern to you and your members?
It's a concern for two reasons. The first is that if this legal challenge results in elements of the TCA being suspended or results in the imposition of tariffs, then it's often small firms that essentially pay for that because their competitiveness is affected. Secondly, the Northern Ireland Protocol, the operation of it is a concern. We need both sides really to have a dialogue on how to make the protocol work for, in particular, small firms in Northern Ireland who are finding it quite difficult at the moment. We need to see that dialogue and that constructive dialogue emerge in the coming weeks, with both sides committed to making the protocol work.
And Ben, would you say Northern Ireland is perhaps the last big hurdle to cross?
Certainly, that's where the most where there's least clarity at the moment, and we're really watching closely the developments about the unilateral decision by the UK to delay checks. So that really does need to be clarified, and does create a certain amount of caution among businesses, because they want to be sure that the terms of this complexly negotiated agreement are fulfilled and complied with, and any diversification from those rules undermines confidence about the agreement in general.
The Remainers in Britain predicted pretty much economic meltdown, economic Armageddon, if the UK left the EU. Do you see any signs of that happening? First of all, you, Ben.
Well, as one of your previous questions implied, there's a mixture of factors at the moment. The economy is in a very bad state. We can't deny that. But clearly the pandemic is factor number one in that. And from an EU perspective, Brexit is of less consequence, but nonetheless, it doesn't help, that's for sure. But businesses are adaptable. They've adapted for decades, for centuries. That's part of what being in business is about, adapting to situations. So there's not going to be economic meltdown, but we just need to make this work as well as we can, because at the moment we really need everything to be as favourable as possible for businesses, given the pandemic that they're having to deal with as well, and all the implications that has.
And James?
I'd agree with a lot of what Ben has just said. I think Armageddon is far too strong a word. The UK and the EU will continue to have a solid trading relationship in the future. At the moment, we're in a very rocky patch. Like I say, we've just undergone the largest change in the UK's trading relationship with the EU and the world in half a century. And there's a lot to work through, and there's a lot for companies to adapt to. But like Ben says, small firms in particular are nimble and adaptable, and they'll do their best to carry on doing business with the EU in the future.
James, have you seen an upside to all of this? And I know that's a difficult question when we are in the middle of a global pandemic. But it was Brexit a good decision economically, do you think?
We've seen some members who've used this as an opportunity. So some businesses are confronting the challenges and new regulatory barriers, for instance, that have been introduced by investing in EU premises or warehouses, creating new jobs. And they tried to really, you know, confront the challenge head on and get over it. And we also see other companies who, you know, they made the investment in customs procedures. And once they're set up for that, it means they're also pretty well set up for non-EU trade as well. So we've seen small firms look to global markets as well as the EU. And so there are some small firms who are seeing opportunities in this. Overall, there are a lot of difficulties for many small companies, but there are some who are really trying to make the best of this quite a delicate situation.
James Sibley, Head of International Affairs at the UK's Federation of Small Businesses, and Ben Butters, thank you very much, CEO of Eurochambers, and thank you both for joining us on The Agenda. Here with me now is Professor Amelia Hadfield, Head of Politics at the University of Surrey, and Carol Lanou, the Chief Executive of the Centre for European Policy Studies. And I'd like to go to you, Professor Hadfield, first. Who would you say, after 100 days, are the winners and the losers?
I think the cold, hard realities of Brexit are certainly beginning to sink in on the British side. And I'll give you an example, and that's probably best seen by the smaller businesses who have been very badly affected by the overnight change in trade rules from the 31st of December. There's new paperwork, there are new rules, there's a rush to secure delivery space, causing widespread delays and extra cost. And I think we have seen the figures. The UK exports to the EU have fallen by a shocking 41% in January, according to government figures. So certainly there's been a bit of a wake-up call from the British side. From the European side, the overarching issue and the tensions with regards to vaccine rollout, I think, have complicated relationships with Britain. There's a very real sense that Britain is winning in this area, although it's not strictly speaking to do with Brexit. But I think the tensions between the two sides have very much magnified their inability to cooperate.
And Carol Lanou, the same question to you. Who are the winners and the losers?
I think both are losers. I mean, we had better stay together and it would have been beneficial for both. And Amy mentioned these figures which have been going around, let's say, about the reduction in trade from the UK to the EU. I don't know about the figures from the EU to the UK, but I think it will be more or less similar. At least I know it for Belgium, let's say, that the trade exports to the UK have gone down as both sides have to adjust to the new rules. So I would say we're basically in a lose-lose situation, and that's what you see reflected politically. That the kind of the rhetoric on both sides is growing, as basically they see it's not a good situation for the economy. But of course, we have the health situation where the UK has clearly done better. And apparently that's due because the person in charge and those which have negotiated the deal have been much tougher in negotiating with the pharmaceutical sector than we have done on the European side. And the EU has taken far too much responsibility in a subject which is not her responsibility, which is a subject for the member state, for every state.
And Professor Hadfield, is the EU bungling its vaccine rollout? And is that down to a lack of ability or because the EU is too big?
I think in many ways it's done very well to nail down a champion with Pfizer-BioNTech, for example. But what has been problematic is getting a program that works, whether it's regional distribution managed by the European Commission in a top-down template or whether it's within each of the countries on a regional basis. And for the longest time, there was disagreement. At the same time, we have to remember, you know, that it is beginning to pick up pace now. It's sort of 6 or 7 weeks behind perhaps where the UK itself was. But the EU hasn't in fact, actually been exporting vaccines using the COVAX regime to developing countries, to countries that still have not been able to produce vaccines of their own. So I think from the humanitarian perspective, actually, it's probably doing better than Britain. But I would agree with Carol. I think the COVID rhetoric has really worsened what was already a very perilous and damaged relationship between the two sides. So the sooner the two get talking to each other, the better.
Carol Lanou, do you think the bungling and the delays and cooperation turning to competition has done any long-term reputational damage to the European Union?
Well, I don't think so. It was to be expected, and we've seen it for the last basically 5 years, let's say, how this rhetoric has been on both sides. Don't forget, we have concluded an agreement at the end of December. It was expected, not expected until a few days before. By the way, in financial services, which is an extremely important export product for the UK, a MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, was concluded at the end of March, so only a few days ago, which has also seemed to be important. And even there, let's say, there has been some loss of jobs, but not that much as some people expected there would be. So London remains, and the UK remains, an extremely important financial centre, will continue to export financial products. And there, of course, unlike goods, I mean, the restrictions are less visible, less difficult, I mean, more difficult to put in place.
And Professor Hadfield, this is Carol Lanou saying, basically, this is a period of adjustment and no long-term damage yet. But what about financially? How is the euro faring against the pound? How is the pound faring against the euro?
Yeah, I would slightly disagree. I think Brexit's been very bad for the City of London. And I think, given it's the capital's financial district, something needs to happen quite quickly in order to be able to kind of roll back that damage. Thousands of jobs have already been lost and billions of euros worth of financial assets have left London. They were leaving them in the last 18 months. Specifically in financial assets, banking and insurance for the most part. And this is because, exactly as Carol said, the Brexit withdrawal agreement preserves free trade between the EU and the UK for goods, but not for services. So the passporting requirements, the ability for Britain to be able to work in within the Eurozone and to have access to EU financial markets simply isn't on the cards at this point. Happily, though, a common framework is on the cards. That's going to be needed. But what I'm hoping is that financial framework is going to be full-blooded and not too thin. It's going to have rules allowing things like professional qualifications for both sides.
Markets seem to like all this because, Carol Lanou, the pound is getting stronger and stronger against the euro.
Yeah, that's probably a bit contradictory situation, let's say, that we've seen. I mean, the UK adapting, at least in the view of the markets, the UK adapting to this new situation. We've seen some important mergers. We've seen also extremely important financial market activity in the domain of IPOs, mergers and acquisitions. That's one thing, which benefit a financial centre like London. But also, don't forget, let's say, that the days or the weeks before, I mean, when the deal was announced at the end of December, there started to be expectation, let's say, that could blow up. So the pound sterling was at one of its lowest levels, let's say, for almost years. So it's basically an adjustment of the exchange rate that, finally, they are coming to a new normal situation. And the current rate should probably a bit more accurately reflect what is in there for the UK economy. Also, don't forget, let's say, the unemployment figures in the UK are not that bad. So the economy is doing well, but probably thanks to a lot of spending by the government.
But I'm wondering whether, because of what's happened with the UK and EU and the strength of the UK at the moment, in inverted commas, would that perhaps suggest other countries in Europe might be looking at a possible Brexit or looking at the UK's example?
I think, you know, the European Union is very, very aware that Brexit cannot set a precedent. And this is one of the reasons why it attained really very impressive unity in negotiating and prevented effectively the UK from trying to ring around the national capitals and divide and rule using the member states, and insisted that it had to go through the EU institution as a whole. I think what has been demonstrated, as Carol said, you know, right at the beginning, you know, membership matters. There are losers on both sides here. And the EU has, you know, worked hard to demonstrate that Britain is not winning by virtue of what it has had to attempted to negotiate with the
EU. It's not winning because of Brexit, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. It just, it could have attained a whole lot more. But the European Union, I think, was also very, very punitive. It could not afford to show other member states that leaving is a benefit in any sense. It had to be an incredibly painful, sad, and somewhat, you know, bruise-making process.
All right, Carol Lanou, are the voices, we're hearing more of the adverse voices from the south of Europe and certainly the east of Europe?
I don't think I wouldn't fear too much of it. You have to see that those where you should fear are what they call the net contributors, basically those who pay for the EU. And there, I mean, I think the most, I mean, the most thought of example was, for example, the Netherlands, which had elections only 2 or 3 weeks ago. And there was a fear, let's say, would the Netherlands ever think about Nexit? But I think that's not on the cards because the party which won most is a very pro-European party. You have to see that those which often speak about leaving, like take Poland or take Hungary, basically get a lot from the EU. If they were to leave, they would be much worse off. So they basically can participate a lot in the rhetoric, like we've seen for both countries, Poland and Hungary. But in the end, they know they earn 2, 3, 4% of GDP from revenues, which coming from other EU countries, which basically contribute to help them out.
So financially, they can't afford to leave?
No. And the same applies basically for two other countries, but which are, Italy has become a bit more skeptic, at least some parties in Italy, but also Italy now and Spain will benefit a lot from what you call the post-crisis recovery resolution tool, which will help these countries massively to recover after the pandemic. And take Italy, which had this Lega Nord, the Salvini party, which was strongly rather against the euro, against the EU, I mean, no seats, let's say, that will have this money only if they remain members of the EU. And this is about 50 billion, imagine.
And Professor Hadfield, can you look in your crystal ball and tell me whether you think there will come a time when the UK will reapply to join the European Union, maybe a different, smaller European Union on different terms? Can you see that happening?
It rather depends what the European Union itself becomes. So my crystal ball, if I give it a good shake, suggests that Britain is not at this point in a position to work its way back to the Union. And it's the institutions that seem to give it a positive allergy at this point. There is a real pathology between what the EU itself as a series of interlocking institutions represent versus the European member states. If the European Union, I think, shifts to something that is a little bit more loose, a bit more multi-level, which frankly, in many ways, it already is, that there may be surface area in the next 20 or 30 years for Britain to be able to find a landing space to come back.
And Carol, would you agree with that?
I think, let's say, there will be other areas will they will have to cooperate. Let's say this important defence review, which the UK had gone through, how important this is for Europe, because Britain has a very credible army and rest of Europe can learn a lot from that. And we have to be aware, let's say, that Russia, but also other countries on the East and take the Middle East, for example, what a mess it still is, that we need to have a clear, credible security umbrella and a kind of a defense threat. But we don't have it at the moment. And that's where we need to cooperate. And that's where, of course, some people say we have NATO. But in certain cases, like we had Libya only a few years ago, where the NATO didn't play a big role and where Europe had to play a role. But in the end, let's say Europe has, certainly the follow-up hasn't done it well. And it's basically other actors in the Middle East, which are taking up the security challenges, not Europe.
Carol Lanou and Professor Amelia Hadfield, thank you both very much for joining us here on The Agenda.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of The Agenda. Next week, charging ahead, I'll be finding out whether the world is really ready to swap the internal combustion engine for all electric cars. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on CGTN Europe Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and a review. Until next week, goodbye.
The most interesting questions.
Are there other living beings beyond Earth?
Will man or machine be in charge?
Great question.
Always have more than one answer.
Well, hold on, let me just draw up a list.
And always come from more than one person.
That's where the credibility lies.
The concept of having a machinery which is alive and evolving didn't wait for us.
The end of inequality of incomes and wealth around the world, can you imagine how difficult that is at the moment to achieve?
Every episode, Stephen Cole, Murray Beveridge, and some of the brightest minds out there shed light on the answers to some of the most intriguing questions.
There are two ways of looking at this.
Machines can't really discriminate between civilian and military targets.
The Answers Project.
Maybe we need to just look at this in a bit more detail.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
The Answers Project, a new podcast from CGTN Europe.